Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa لا
name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is his. Who is he that can intercede with him but by his permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of his knowledge except what he pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and he is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories. India reports over 850 new daily COVID deaths, taking its total toll beyond 400,000. It has also registered nearly 47,000 new daily infections. Australia's most populous state of New South Wales warns residents to brace for an increase in COVID-19 infections as it reports the biggest daily rise for this year. Also ahead, the U.S. budget deficit is forecast to hit $3 trillion in 2021, amounting to one of the biggest imbalances between federal spending and revenue in American history. Welcome to the program. India's total deaths from the pandemic, that is the coronavirus pandemic, have surpassed 400,000 after the country registered more than 850 fatalities in the past 24 hours. India also reported over 46,600 new cases during the same period. The total is now above 30.4 million there. The country witnessed a surge in COVID in April and May. That pushed daily cases there above 400,000 in May. A new variant called Delta, which is highly transmissible, was identified afterwards. The strain has been reported in dozens of other countries as well, causing flare-ups and prompting new curbs. On Friday, South Korea's daily case or case count topped 800, the highest there in nearly 6 months. Thailand also reported record deaths for a third straight day with 61 fatalities. Our New Delhi correspondent Manohar Zaman says, when it comes to Indian rural areas, there is a discrepancy between officially announced daily COVID figures and the real numbers.
India is a vast country as a huge geographical area. You don't have the counts of people dying from the virus because in the far-flung areas, there is no actual picture of what's happening if you go to the rural parts of the country. So these figures, what we are quoting, these are the figures that the government has maintained some records and, of course, the death tolls. But if we talk about the cities in particular, there has been some shift in the number of cases, daily cases, because there was a day before a couple of weeks or 3 weeks ago where we used to see hundreds of thousands of cases being registered on a daily basis. Now, there's a lot of difference in that, though the cases have come down drastically. And as we recorded yesterday, 47,000 cases and some 875 deaths, or something like that. Well, that looks like that's always something which is not completely trusted, because the data is not maintained properly. There's no database of the number of people dying in rural parts of the country. So yes, of course, we can say to some extent, if we believe the government figures and if we go by the data collected by different government agencies, so yes, there is a lot of shift. The coronavirus cases have come down, but many health experts believe that this is not going to be it. So we have to be prepared for the third wave, which is imminent and which is probably going to come in the month of October.
The Australian state of New South Wales has warned residents to brace for a rise in COVID infections over the next few days. Warning comes as daily cases have already jumped in New South Wales. They were 31 on Friday, the biggest daily rate this year. The state's capital, Sydney, is halfway through a two-week lockdown and was imposed to fight a surge in cases caused by the more infectious Delta variant. Three other state capitals are also under lockdown to fight their outbreaks of the strain. State officials have called on Australia's federal government to limit the number of international arrivals until the country reaches high vaccination coverage. Over 100 local civic groups are staging a march across South Korea to demand the relinking of the railway connecting North and South Korea. The march began on April the 27th in Busan, a southern port city. Jennifer Chang reports.
Over 120 South Korean civic groups have held a 550-kilometer cross-country march to demand the railway networks of South and North Korea be reconnected. The march is marked by press conferences such as this one. The march began in the southern port city of Busan on April 27th, the anniversary of a summit of South Korea's President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un 3 years ago. In that meeting, the two leaders released a declaration pledging to relink the railway, which was severed in 1945 with Korea's division.
This event aims to get South Korea's public to pressure President Moon to honor his Panmunjom Declaration pledge to achieve peaceful unification by relinking the railway. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's U.S.-led sanctions on the North over its nuclear program are blocking the project.
The march is scheduled to end in the northern border city Paju on July 27th.
The march will end at Imjingak Peace Nuri Park near the inter-Korean border on July 27th, the Korean War Armistice anniversary.
After the press conference, about 100 protesters watched a promotional video of the march before a four-hour rally in Incheon.
In 2000, two Korean states had their first summit and decided to restart railway link. It was restarted in 2007 and again disconnected in 2008. On the summit in 2018, they decided to have another go. They had a survey of the path of the future railway link, but now the major decision has to be made by the U.S. administration. And it's unlikely that President Biden makes any decision until after the South Korean presidential elections, which are scheduled for March next year.
Many bystanders welcomed the march. At its destination, Guodong Rodeo Street, a hotspot with huge crowds from Incheon and nearby cities like Bucheon, a mass campaign with broadcasts and leaflets took place.
During our march, we've seen huge public support for it in every place, even Daegu, South Korea's fourth biggest city and traditionally a conservative stronghold.
Many experts say the successful relinking of the inter-Korean railway would be a major accomplishment for South Korea, one that would supplement the South's maritime trade with new land trade routes with its continental neighbors. Jennifer Chang, Incheon, South Korea.
The United States federal deficit this year is projected to hit $3 trillion, one of the highest recorded in American history. The new figure released by the Congressional Budget Office is slightly lower than that of last year, but three times more than the one in 2019. The Budget Office attributed the rise to the country's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package. Federal agency expects the U.S. government to start to earn more revenue after the pandemic ends and the nation returns to normalcy. Colin Campbell says the U.S. is also facing a rise in inflation.
What we are in trouble of is inflation. And of course, that's happening as we come out of the COVID-19 restrictions, where we saw a plunge in market activity and people buying and selling. And now that that's happening, you have a rush of people wanting certain goods and services, wanting to go out to eat. And the demand rises, therefore the supply is probably somewhat suppressed. So we're starting to see price raises in prices contributing to inflation. This is happening not just in the real estate sector, but also in food and dining sectors and travel. And so a lot of people are already grumbling about the feelings of inflation, even though it's not a major topic of conversation here in the U.S. right now.
A U.S. defense official says all American and NATO troops have left Afghanistan's Bagram Air Base, located in the north of the capital, Kabul. The official spoke on a condition of anonymity and did not specify when the troops left the base. The official neither said when the base will be officially handed over to Afghan forces. Some 9,600 foreign troops should leave Afghanistan by a deadline of September the 11th. The deadline was set that is by U.S. President Joe Biden, who seeks to end America's longest war. NATO members Germany and Italy have already completed their troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. The U.S. and its allies invaded the country in 2001 under the pretext of fighting terrorism. No peace has been achieved yet, while hundreds of thousands have already been killed. Palestinians have expressed strong disapproval of the German president's opposition to the International Criminal Court's probe into Israeli war crimes. Resistance movement Hamas and said that as Frank Walter Steinmeier's remarks are a blatant support for Israel's aggressive policies against the Palestinian nation. Hamas said such remarks will encourage Israel to continue its crimes and put the regime above international law. Palestinian Foreign Ministry also said the status of the state of Palestine at the international level is not subject to the opinions of the German president or his state. Steinmeier had said the ICC has no jurisdiction to probe Israeli crimes due to the absence of Palestinian statehood. Israeli army has carried out airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, hitting areas south of Gaza City. No casualties have been reported so far. Tel Aviv claims that the air raid was in response to Palestinians sending incendiary balloons toward the occupied territories. The strike follows Israel's 11-day aggression against Gaza. In May, the conflict ended on May the 21st after a ceasefire. Nearly 260 Palestinians, half of them women and children, were killed. Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel in response, killing a dozen people. Well, the spokesman for Iraq's al-Nujaba resistance movement said that Iraqi resistance forces are capable of retaliating against the recent U.S. attack on the country's popular mobilization units.
Hajj al-Shaabi or the popular mobilization units try to acquire military equipment that can defend defend their country and can boost the deterrence of their country. That's why Hajj al-Shaabi is capable right now to retaliate and attain and acquire aerial armament to stand against the American troops. And
Shamari said the recent U.S. attack was a terrorist act. The spokesman urged the United States to withdraw its troops from the country. He noted that the presence of American forces in Iraq is illegal. Last year, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously passed a bill mandating the expulsion of all foreign troops from the country. The spokesman also called on the Iraqi government to take a stronger position against U.S. attacks on PMU forces.
These violations has a number of reasons. The first reason is that the Iraqi government is weak. Now in Iraq, we need to take a real stance to summon the American ambassador and condemn such an act of aggression against the Iraqi sovereignty and to hold the American government responsible for such a violation of our sovereignty.
Shamari said the United States failed in its attempts to pit Iraq's army against the PMU forces. He added that Washington now wants to take the matters into its own hands and deal a blow to resistance groups. The United States targeted positions of the resistance forces along Iraq-Syria border on Monday. The PMU says four of its members were killed in the airstrikes. Iran's envoy to the UN Geneva office Says the assassination of Iranian Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is state terrorism. Ismail Baghaei Hamane said the assassination of General Soleimani, who was a true human rights defender, an opponent of Daesh occupation and terrorism, was a barbaric, arbitrary, unjust, and illegal act. He added that the move was an international crime that threatened global peace and security. Baghaei noted that Iranian people will never give up seeking justice for the heinous crime. Top Iranian General Soleimani and Iraqi Commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated by U.S. forces near Baghdad in January of 2020. Former U.N. Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard described the U.S. move as arbitrary and against international rules and the U.N. Charter. Iran is marking the week of American Human Rights. The annual occasion marks a series of tragic incidents that killed Iranian people and statesmen, or the U.S. was directly or indirectly involved. Youssef Jaloli has more.
Every year in late June and early July, Iranians flock to this graveyard in southern Tehran and sprinkle rose petals on these tombs. Buried here are the victims of a terrorist attack in 1981 that bombed the central office of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, killing 73 key officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, who was viewed as the second man of the nascent Islamic Republic after its founder, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini.
I lost my father in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Party's headquarters. I was 9 back then. I still miss him so much, and I come here every year to commemorate him.
The killing of the Iranian politicians back then was a terrorist act that was supported by the U.S. The terrorists are now residing in France, so we ask the French government to hand them over to face justice.
The formidable Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization took responsibility for the 1981 bombing. Known as the MKO, the terror group has a history of assassinations against Iranian statesmen and civilians, killing at least 12,000 Iranians.
Ask any Iranian about the MKO, and they will call them munafiqin, the Persian word for hypocrites. This is because they call themselves the crusaders of people's cause, but in fact, they killed people to climb to power. What's even more ironic is the fact that the U.S. and some other Western countries nourish the MKO terrorists.
This man is believed to be the spearhead of the 1981 terror attack. After the incident, Mohammad Reza Kolahi sought refuge in the Netherlands under the false identity of Ali Mohtamed, where he was warmly accommodated until he was disposed of by the MKO in 2015.
When Mr. Kolahi fled Iran to the Netherlands, Iran asked the Netherlands to hand him over, but it didn't do so. This shows that the West has a selective approach to terrorism.
This is not where the West's support for the terror group ends. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. Following this measure, the group was relocated from its former stronghold at a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials. The 1981 assassination of Iranian officials, along with other similar events, such as the 1988 downing of an Iranian passenger plane by the U.S. Army and Iraq's chemical bombardment of Sardasht, falls in the same time frame, between June 26th and July the 3rd. U.S. footprints can be traced in all of the incidents. That's why Iran has designated this period as the Week of American Human Rights, as a jab that questions the U.S. double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
People cannot feel safe just because they had the two doses, announced WHO Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines and Health Products, Maria Angela Siamo. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by William Rivers Pitt, writer. This article is published under the heading, As Delta Variant Spreads, WHO Urges Masks and Social Distancing. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The World Health Organization, WHO, dropped a large and dispiriting brick. Due to the sprinting rise of the Delta COVID-19 variant, everyone needs to continue wearing masks and keep practicing social distancing. For millions of vaccinated people who have rolled in the freedoms newly provided by the shots, this was profoundly unwelcome news. People cannot feel safe just because they had the two doses, announced WHO Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines and Health Products, Mariangela Siamo. They still need to protect themselves. Vaccine alone won't stop community transmission. People need to continue to use masks consistently, be in ventilated spaces, hand hygiene and physical distance, avoid crowding. This will continue to be extremely important, even if you're vaccinated when you have a community transmission ongoing. The abundance of caution on display is due to the Delta viral variant, which was born in the cauldron of India's ongoing COVID misery and has begun making itself at home and around the world. That you see is the merciless genius of the virus. It seeks only to replicate itself within human hosts and is always evolving to thwart our immunological vaccinated defenses. Alphabetically, chronologically, the virus is getting better and better at its primary objective, infecting us. And experts suspect that it may be a while yet before the pathogen's contagious potential truly maxes out, writes Catherine J. Wu for The Atlantic, adding, as long as the virus has hosts to infect, it will keep shape-shifting in ways we can't fully predict. That biological caprice makes it harder to anticipate the next pandemic hurdles we will need to clear and assess the dangers still ahead. One of the inescapable question marks that arise when dealing with this willy foe concerns the vaccinations themselves. Do they work on the variants? Will they always work on the variants? How safe am I after having gotten the shots? Turns out it may partly depend on which shot you got. Vaccines set off
a persistent immune reaction in the body that may protect against the coronavirus for years, reported the New York Times recently. The findings add to growing evidence that most people immunized with the mRNA vaccines may not need boosters, so long as the virus and its variants do not evolve much beyond their current forms, which is not guaranteed. People who recovered from COVID-19 before being vaccinated may not need boosters, even if the virus does make a significant transformation. Strange how this the recent announcement about vaccination effectiveness came on the heels of the recent WHO advisory that we should all continue to wear masks. Maybe not so strange. The inescapable truth emerging from this ongoing crisis is that very little of it is, in fact, under control. Half the U.S. population remains unvaccinated, including children under 12. And certain segment of that unvaccinated population disdains even the most unobtrusive protections as an affront to freedom because Trump. Many areas of the world beyond the U.S. borders are struggling to contend with the pandemic, allowing the virus to replicate variants that will continue to test progress, if not subsume it altogether. There are concerns that what people have experienced this spring and summer in the U.S. could possibly be a false dawn. Fake light from the other side of the tunnel that is actually another onrushing train. Thanks to the vaccines, the impact may not be as severe, but the ideological divide in this country is mutating into an immunological divide and cannot be bridged with words and promises or prices. Add to that the racist gap in vaccine access, and the recipe for another gruesome winter is before Americans all. Don't toss those masks just yet.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
Just like a fascist empire would normally behave, another unilateral move by the United States once more promises to affect lives of people around the world for the worse, this time in terms of internet freedom. In an expected move on Tuesday, June 22nd, the U.S. Justice Department seized 36 websites with links to the Islamic Republic of Iran and its regional allies for engaging in, quote, disinformation campaigns and malign influence operations, unquote. The move initially arose suspicions of a hack since a disclaimer that said this website has been seized accompanied an Arabic text as the one you can still see on PressTV.com. While State Department spokesman Ned Price refused to comment. The Empire's Justice Department eventually said three of the seized domains belonged to the Iraqi group Kata'ab Hezbollah, while the rest, including Yemeni, Palestinian, and Bahraini outlets in English and Arabic, were supported by the Iranian Islamic Radio and Television Union. The seized websites obviously belonged to outlets of the allied resistance communities, better known as the Resistance Axis, that Iran supports across the region to counter the influence of the U.S. and regional rivals like Israel and Saudi Arabia. Try to keep a straight face here. The U.S. blacklisted us with designations related to terrorism. I kid you not. the mother of all terrorism, also known as the Empire, said that the American companies are not allowed to provide us with .com and .net domains without special authorization from the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC. U.S. fascist officials can choose to label it however they wish, yet they will never be able to change the fact that this seizure is a clear example of a systematic effort to distort freedom of speech on a global level and silence independent voices in media, which gives us and everyone included in the seizure the full right to pursue the issue through legal channels. While the U.S. may have given itself the ability to exert influence over vast sections of the internet, its actions will for sure have far-reaching ramifications beyond its control. Those unilateral harassment actions will only give credence to arguments of U.S. interference and censoring due to fear of being further exposed by native media in nations they continue to sanction like Iran, occupy like Iraq, and bomb like Yemen. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Amar Osman. More than 30 web domains linked to the Axis of Resistance, one of which is Press TV, were blatantly seized by U.S. agencies last week. The U.S. seized sites operated inside Iran, Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon, as well as social media channels affiliated with the Iraqi resistance, the PMU. The seizures come as the Biden administration is in the midst of negotiations over Tehran's nuclear program and follow the election of a new president who has been criticized by Washington for being a staunch detractor of its imperial foreign policy. Now, the Iranian government condemned this act of censorship as unlawful and part of an influence campaign against the Islamic Republic of Iran. To discuss this issue with us in Beirut is Hadi Shatila, founder of iBreathe Media and a tech expert. Thank you very much for being with us, Hadi. Now, visitors of the affected websites by the seizure, by the U.S. Seizure, were greeted with a banner that says that the domain name has been seized by the U.S. government as part of, I quote, enforcement action taken by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Bureau of Industry and Security. Now, if you want to define and maybe phrase this, just put it into words, how would you do that?
First of all, we need to understand one thing, which is that what happened was that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has seized the DNS side of the website, not the actual site. So it's what tells the when a person browses for a site, he types a name. The DNS service is what tells the browser that this name belongs to this IP address. This link is what the Federal Bureau of Investigation has seized. That's basically what happened in the first part.
So that would you putting it into actual words, but that actual seizure from a tech point of view, how much time would have that have taken, and what would the tools be that they use to do that?
Since they have access to the actual DNS service from a local company inside the U.S., which runs these DNS addresses, they can do it easily with one court order. They can directly seize control on anything which is considered on U.S. soil.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you an Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokeswoman had declared when that happened before, it declared that this act of, we can call it internet fascism by the U.S., was performed that by the U.S. government because it has a right to seize the .com, .net, and .org domain names simply because the companies have the contracts to administer them are based on U.S. soil. If that is the case, wouldn't such actions urge people to move away from these domain names to try and at least protect their work?
Well, basically, they should understand. The people should start to understand that since there is no actual real internet governance, which is in unbiased hands, they should know that whenever they buy any of these domains, they are susceptible to being seized by the U.S. government. Knowing that, if you want to go to the legal side of it, the U.S. should only be enforcing whatever ends with a .us. So it might be .com, then .us. Or, for example, in Lebanon, .com.lb, in whatever other country, .me, for example. It depends on which country. So each country can have access to its own domains if it was the unbiased way to achieve such a thing. But sadly, what's happening is that they have control over all the .com, the .net, even the .org, since the companies that run these domains are on American soil, and VeriSign, which is the company that runs the .com and .nets, is very very closely tied to the system.
You mentioned VeriSign, Hadi, and it's a U.S.-based internet backbone, a company that has the contract to manage the coveted.com and other generic top-level domains, the ones that you just mentioned, and it has a very cozy relationship, and I mean cozy, that's described by the U.S. media, not by me, with the federal government, with the FBI, and has long had a contract from the U.S. government to help manage the internet's root file, which is the key to having a unified internet name system. What would now stop other international corporations for assigned names and numbers from following suit of unleashing a global government crackdown on domain names that simply do not abide by Western values or Western narratives, or just simply are not liked by the US, the UK, or any other Western regime?
Again, sadly, we are at a point where nothing can stop such seizures happening in anywhere in the world, since they have ultimate access to all these things. There's the ICANN, I-C-A-N-N. They were under American control for some time, and then they released that control, and they started making 13 multiple organizations governing each part of the world. They are non-governmental organization. They don't get paid by any government. And they are one step towards global internet governance, trying to make internet unbiased location. But still, the US hasn't released its hand over these names. So we get to a loop where we are susceptible to have our domains seized at any moment just by being connected to any ideology or any political stance which is maybe anti-US or anti-West, or maybe not doesn't go well with US comprehension of things.
Or simply, if you're going to compete with the US, we did see that happening to a lot of also Chinese websites where they were seized, they were put down. But I had a technical question concerning something that you mentioned about the .com.lb, for example. Is that more secure from the .com by itself? If I'm going to go with the .com.ir instead of just .com, should that be more safe than just going with the domain name .ir?
Your own country's domain, for example, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, there's the .ir, which is governed by Iranian law. It has nothing to do with American governance over the internet. So, of course, it's much safer to invest in your own domain. And maybe if you want, you can link a .com to it for SEO purposes, which later on might have other issues. But that's another technical path.
So you mean that only having a .ir might make it hard to find it on a search engine?
Yes, true. Because the crawlers work in a different way, and also the search engine itself might be biased. It might push things which aren't actually relevant.
Hello, Google.
Exactly.
Well, many outside the United States, like China, Russia, India, they distrust this U.S. cozy tech companies, especially with the big tech companies, the social media ones, and have been vocal about wanting to see control being shared all across the world, which is just fair, at least to say it's fair, of the internet's naming system. They want to see it turned over to an organization such as the International Telecommunications Union, an affiliate of the United Nations. Now, look, Once you say UN, I for one, as a citizen of West Asia, I am a bit panicking once I hear the word UN. Why? Because it is an international body, but it's a biased body.
True.
So what are we actually doing here?
Maybe this makes it less susceptible to U.S. seizure, but in the end it will be biased. But since it presents itself as an unbiased organization, it gives us a range of movement to work with such institutes.
So it might actually protect domain names, or might just get them on board a certain committee that would have to study if that domain name
exactly.
is used or not.
It gets them maybe on the side where instead of having, like, for example, you sleep and then you wake up with 30 plus websites being seized, you'll wake up with a warning, and then things will start to take a bit of meetings from here, discussions there, debates here, until they get to a certain...
But wouldn't that just threaten freedom of speech?
At the end of the day, it is
a form of censorship.
Exactly, that's what's happening.
Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you very much, Hadi Shatila, founder
of
iBreathe Media, for explaining to us what actually happened when the U.S. blatantly decided to take over our websites and the websites of our sister channels as well. Thank you very much for being with us. It was great content from you, Hadi, and please stay tuned because next we will be talking about what is going on in the occupied West Bank.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Seems that death in Palestinian authority custody no longer differs than that of the Israeli occupation's use of ruthless excessive force against Palestinians during incarceration, and that's being said sadly. An outspoken critic of the Palestinian Authority who intended to run in the parliamentary elections before they were actually canceled earlier this May died during his arrest in Hebron by Palestinian Authority forces on Thursday. Yizhar Banat, 44 years old, was a harsh critic of the Palestinian Authority, which governs part of the Israeli-occupied West Bank, and called on Western nations to cut off aid to it because of its growing authoritarianism and human rights violations. More in this following report.
Hundreds of Palestinian natives continue to gather on a daily basis in the city of Ramallah to protest over the death of activist Yizhar Banat after being dragged by excessive force out of his home on Thursday, June 24th at 3:30 a.m. in the morning by the Palestinian Authority security forces. Angry demonstrators gathered in the city of Ramallah, the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority, to chant slogans against President Mahmoud Abbas 2 days after Abbas's forces arrested and killed activist Yizhar Banat. They carried Palestinian flags, photos of Banat, and signs demanding the fall of the regime. Protests were also held in Hebron and El Bire. Palestinian security forces then launched a heavy barrage of tear gas into the crowd of hundreds in Ramallah and attacked protesters and several journalists. Earlier, plainclothes security forces spread out among protesters as they marched from the center of Ramallah towards the presidential offices and closed off the intersection leading to the area, forcing shops to close. One video from the protest showed security forces in plain clothes dragging a protester across the road as they simultaneously beat him.
القيادة الفلسطينية التقليدية هذه اللي حكمت الضفة الغربية اليوم طول عمرها هيك بتتاجر بكل شيء.
But who is Banat and why is his death, which some is now dubbing as an assassination, so significant? The prominent Palestinian political activist and an advocate of free speech was known for his outspoken videos on social media criticizing the Palestinian Authority for its corruption, as well as its shameful security coordination with the Israeli occupation forces in the occupied West Bank. A former member of the Farah movement himself, the de facto ruling party of the Palestinian Authority, Banat had been campaigning as a candidate for legislative elections on the Freedom and Dignity list. The elections initially scheduled for May were postponed by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in April. While Abbas cited the voting rights of Palestinians living in occupied East Al-Quds as a reason to push back the elections, critics have accused him of seeking excuses to avoid a vote due to his party's unpopularity. Banat was well known for his extensive knowledge of Palestinian political and social history, often recalling anecdotes about the Palestinian Liberation Organization PLO in the 1970s or the British Mandate of Palestine before 1948 in order to make his point. In May, bullets, stun grenades, and tear gas were fired at the Banat family home while his wife and children were inside. Banat accused ruling party Fatah of being behind the attack and called on the European Union to cut its financial aid to the Palestinian Authority. Banat had also accused the Palestinian Authority of perpetrating torture on political dissidents detained in its prisons. Hence, his sudden death while in the hands of the Palestinian Authority sparked outrage and dismay in the Palestinian streets, which many believe has triggered the inevitable downfall of the Palestinian Authority.
So with us to discuss this issue is Mr. Ali Murad, who's a political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, just like that, a brief statement was given by the Hebron Governorate saying that Nizar Banat's health deteriorated while he was in custody when Palestinian forces arrested him from his house earlier on Thursday, and that he was taken to a hospital where he was pronounced dead. This is definitely not the first case where we see a detainee dying while in custody of the Palestinian Authority security forces. However, this man was known to have faced direct threats from members of the Palestinian Authority. How come this matter escalated to a point that whoever arrested him ended up just murdering him?
Thank you for hosting me. Of course, martyr Nizar Banat was threatened nearly on a daily basis. He had told his friends and his family that he is receiving death threats weeks before the assassination took place. Nizar's problem is that he was outspoken. He never, ever was able to louder his voice when talking about the corruption of the Palestinian Authority and all the security apparatus that Mahmoud Abbas rules the West Bank using it. So Nizar Banat, I think, was the man who had the bravery and all the strength that many others lack. He used his voice to speak. He never held a gun to shoot at the security forces or any member of the Palestinian Authority. All he had his voice, his bravery, talking about what is wrong, the corruption, the security coordination with the Zionist enemy that Mahmoud Abbas is insisting on keeping. So I think other circumstances maybe has led to the assassination of Nizar, because after the battle of the Al-Quds sword, the Palestinian Authority sensed that the popularity, its popularity is going down. So
Mr. Ali, before I even contacted you to come and be our guest speaker, I spoke with four different Palestinian natives living in the West Bank who canceled right after actually saying, yes, we'd be happy to talk about Nizar, but they canceled because they were afraid that they would be incarcerated
exactly.
themselves. So it's a real police state there.
Exactly.
And as you said, Nizar didn't even have a weapon to defend himself, because weapons are also not allowed because of the coordination, the security coordination with Israel. But in early May, he had gunmen firing bullets, tear
exactly.
gas, grenade, stun grenades at his house while his wife and his children were inside the house. He blamed the attack on Mahmoud Abbas himself and the Fatah party. Now, is there something that could have been done to avert them attacking his house again, or is it just too complicated to talk about it as if it's something that should not happen? Because we don't really have a lot of information coming out of the West Bank.
Exactly. But we have to know something before to answer this, because if you take a look at the history of the relation between Nizar and the security apparatus of Abu Mazen, you'll find out that he was taken to as a detainee for like 10 times or 15 times before. He was beaten. He was at several times his bones were crushed, and still Nizar remained the same. In other ways, Nizar was sending a message that no matter how violent you were in dealing with me, in trying to oppress me, in trying to silence me, I will not be silent. I will remain speaking. He went to run for elections, the elections that Mahmoud Abbas canceled during the last month.
In May, yeah.
Yes. So all the voices that declared that they are against the way that Mahmoud Abbas is ruling regarding the elections and regarding the corruption with the coronavirus vaccines, also with all the security coordination with the Zionist entity.
The goal of the coordination with the Israeli entity, is it he learned from them how to suppress his own people?
Actually, he is getting paid to prevent resistance. This is the main role of the Palestinian Authority. The Oslo Accords made it clear that any authority that the Palestinian Authority to rule in the West Bank, it has to do this to prevent any act of resistance. Now I believe Mahmoud Abbas moved into another step by silencing all the voices. We are not talking about taking guns or putting resistance activists inside jail. We are talking about oppression that is not serving. It's serving the goal of a dictatorship. We are talking about a dictator now. Mahmoud Abbas has turned himself into a dictator. He is no different than other dictators.
What are the options left for the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank to try and at least fix the situation? We don't want Palestinians fighting one another, but what options do they have?
Because the Palestinian Authority is acting as an agent of the enemy, it left no choice for the Palestinians, for the majority of the Palestinians who want to resist the occupation. They want to liberate their lands. So we are seeing now, since the assassination of Nizar, there are protests taking place in more than one city and in many villages in the West Bank.
It's on a daily basis. It's
yes.
Not ending.
I think this is the available choice now. Maybe there has to be done, something has to be done inside the Fatah movement, because there are free people, there are real patriots in the Fatah movement. They have to rebel against their leadership. They have to change this leadership, because in the era of victories, with the victory that the resistance
achieved last month,
the same way that Mahmoud Abbas is still ruling is outdated. I believe that
definitely incompatible. Definitely, it's something to really think about and give way for the Palestinians to decide for themselves, obviously. But we hope the best for all our Palestinian brothers in the face of the occupation. Thank you very much, Ali Murad, political commentator, for joining us from Beirut to talk about the assassination of Nizar Banat, the Palestinian activist, sadly at the hands of Palestinian authority security forces. Thank you very much for being with us. And please stay tuned. Next week, we have more for you on the Middle East Stream.
limelight.
Britain's Met Office climate forecasts estimate that without radical action to halt global carbon emissions, Glasgow's maximum summer temperatures will rise by at least 1.1 degrees Celsius by 2030 and by 2.6 degrees Celsius by 2080. We now present you an article authored by Severin Carroll. The piece is titled, Report Says Billions Needed to Protect Glasgow from Climate Effects. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The report says nearly 2 million people living in the Greater Glasgow area face severe disruption from climate heating unless billions of pounds are invested in protecting homes, businesses and transport links. A study on the impacts of climate change on the Clyde area estimates about 140,000 of its poorest residents will be the worst affected by increased heat waves, by flash floods and droughts, as they are the least equipped to cope. The report from Climate Ready Clyde, or CRC, a coalition of 15 councils, universities, the NHS and infrastructure bodies, has been published as Glasgow prepares to host the COP26 Global Climate Talks this November. It estimates there is already a funding shortfall of at least £184 million a year to begin retrofitting homes and offices for heatwaves, defending roads and rail links against flooding and storms.